You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Ed Song, an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California, right?
Santa Barbara, California, yes.
And am I allowed to announce your other position yet, or is that still top secret?
The thing about being the guru to the world? No, you can announce that.
Oh, yeah. So Ed is also some kind of soulless administrator. I don't really know all of the details about it, but he will probably explain it to us.
I'm taking care of internships at Westmont. That's one thing that I'm doing. I don't know that it affects my title, though. My title is still the same, but just the things that I do for the college has... My portfolio has expanded.
Sort of a more work but not much more pay kind of thing?
No. Luckily, my labor is being compensated by wages, which is appropriate, by fair wages, I would even say, which is appropriate given what we were talking about today. In previous episodes, we have tackled the big political ideologies of the modern world. We've talked about liberalism and conservatism and libertarianism. What we haven't gotten to yet is Marxism, which Coyle and I wanted to tackle. And given the breadth of the topic, we're actually going to make this a two-parter. In our episode today, we're going to sort of talk about Marx the man, the theory, and the theory itself. What we'll tackle in a subsequent episode is the effect of this theory in 20th century politics, as well as its applicability in our current contemporary situation. So stay tuned for that in a upcoming part two to this episode in the not so distant future.
Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about the ideology that has killed more people than any other, at least in the 20th century, if not ever. Its flags are waved by leftists at protests, and its heroes are worn on T-shirts and hung in the dorms of college students. This is of course, communism. So Ed is our resident communist on the podcast. Why don't we?
Is this how it's going to be through this episode?
Oh, I hope so. maybe not all the way through the episode. I will say, you in some ways believe in the free market more than I do, and in other ways not so much. I think it just depends on.
Yeah,
I
think you like Bernie Sanders more than I do. Well, in a way.
Yeah, I mean his beliefs are repellent, but
I'm more free market, I think, than you are. So if there is a Marx T-shirt to be worn, I'm not sure that I'm the one wearing it.
Yeah, and I mean it depends on the context. I would say, well, it doesn't depend on the context. There's not really a context in which I am a communist. But there are times when I'm less enamored with the free market, I think, than you are.
Yeah, in some ways, all of those paradoxes get to some of the complexities in Marx's thought. I mean, I certainly wouldn't call myself a Marxist. I am a liberal. I am solidly a liberal. But there are aspects of Marx's critique of capitalism that I think are really super interesting and have been revived in recent times to sort of make sense of contemporary economic life. I think that stuff is really interesting. I'm not a Marxist in my politics. But then again, one of the interesting things about Marx's politics is that... So he generates this theory of political economy, this critique of capitalism, that does in fact recommend a set of political institutions, or maybe you could say it recommends the absence of political institutions. But, you know, Marx develops that whole theory. But then the extent to which that theory gets put into practice in the history of the 20th century is very distant from the theory itself. there are lots of reasons why Marx would have said that the Soviet project would never work, that mode of instituting a communist set of political institutions was never going to work because the Soviet Union hadn't achieved the requisite level of technological development. That's something that we're going to get to. But all of this is to say that, you know, your earlier comment about who the Marxist in the room is gets at a lot of the complexities in Marx, like the gap between his theory and 20th century political history. But anyways, speaking of political history, why don't you kick us off with a little bit of historical background on the man himself?
Yeah, and I think part of the problem is related to the man himself. So Marx, born in 1818 in Prussia, the son of a secular Jewish lawyer, was just an absolutely brilliant student, especially in the areas of literature and art. But in many ways, was a typical college student. So he was arrested for drunkenness and dueling his first year of college.
Which of us haven't been arrested for drunkenness and dueling?
I have not been arrested for drunkenness. So there you go. And dueling's illegal anyway, so you know, I guess I haven't been arrested for that either. In fact, I don't know that I've ever, I have not yet been arrested so far, right? So who knows what'll happen down the road?
Well, there's always tomorrow, Coyle.
Right. Although I'm also not a college student anymore, so he majored in philosophy, especially studying the thought of Hegel. He was so enamored with Hegel, he actually joined a left-leaning group called the Young Hegelians. Which ultimately kept him from being able to do what he wanted to do, that was go on and teach at the college level. So instead, he becomes a journalist, which he was absolutely amazing at until the government shuts his paper down. After that, he moves to Belgium, where he writes the Communist Manifesto, after which he is then kicked out of Belgium. He returns to Germany, starts a newspaper. Sorry, returns to Prussia, starts a new newspaper, in which he calls for the people of Paris to resist tyranny by not paying their taxes. The Prussian government arrests him for sedition and puts him on trial. At his trial, he gives such a rousing speech in his own defense that the jury gives him a standing ovation and lets him go. The Prussian government was much less impressed than the jury. They expel him from the country. He immigrates to England, where he works as a journalist for the New York Tribune, basically for the rest of his life. He follows politics very closely, becomes convinced that the Great Revolution is going to begin in either Russia or Turkey, but he dies before it kicks off in 1883. On his death, Engels, his collaborator, said that Marx's great contribution was reminding people that sort of material goods have to be first in politics. If people don't have enough to eat, then it doesn't matter what moral positions government is taking. You've always got to start with the material, which I think is probably fair. Intellectually, Marx is one of the German idealists. He is especially following George Hegel. Hegel. I don't know that Hegel can be summarized in 5 to 10 minutes we have in a podcast to do it. Particularly, his philosophy of history is complicated and interesting. The rough outline is that in history there's a thesis and an antithesis. Those two things together lead to a synthesis. So one example he uses in the Oriental world, the world of Babylon and Persia and so on, you have one person who is free and everyone else is a slave. That's the thesis, right? The historical statement that is true. There arises an antithesis, a historical statement that is equally true, but completely the opposite of the original thesis. So the Oriental world is opposed by the Greco-Roman world, where you have, in the Greco-Roman world, you have many people, or at least more people who are free. Those two things come into collision. And the result is a new world where you have sort of the best of both. In this case, it's what Hegel calls the Christian world, where everybody is free. And by the Christian world, he really means sort of early 19th century, the early 19th century German states. So he's
skipping over a little bit of time there.
Yeah. This is a historical process, right? It takes centuries and centuries to work out.
Yeah. One thing about Hegelianism, like in some ways, Hegelianism is kind of like the rhythms and narrative of religion, but within the confines of like a secular philosophical theory. So,
well, it's religious too, right? It's not secular. Like this is something that God is doing.
Yeah, well, quasi-religious, because that God certainly isn't like the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Right. It's not the Trinitarian God of the Bible, but it is certainly. There is certainly a theistic movement at work.
Yeah, but it's almost pantheistic, right? So the idea is that Geist or spirit is working its way out via the evolution of ideas in human history. But like, but it's religious in the sense that it is teleological. But the thing that's driving the teleology are these like is spirit manifesting itself in the world, manifesting itself through these ideas that get instantiated and then kind of conflict, work it themselves out, and then kind of have paradoxes that conflict, but that lead to the new thing, right? So you have thesis, antithesis that generates this new social structure and way of life. But that history is evolving in that way.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, so, and then I was just going to quibble with one thing. You said that Marx was a German idealist.
Yes.
And like, I think that's not right. He's certainly informed by German idealism. But the big thing with Marx is that he breaks with that idealist story about the evolution of history in place of a materialist one.
Well, he does and he doesn't. So Marx himself says is that he takes Hegel and turns him on his head, which is sort of right and sort of not right. So if with Hegel you have this sort of spectrum of or this formula of God works through history, not necessarily the personal Christian God, but the providence, I guess, works through history and leads mankind towards more freedom, more reason, more Geist in the world, that untranslatable German word, right? Marx takes this, and as you point out, he modifies it. He says, forget God, this is really all about material goods. So in that sense, he's not an idealist in that there is no spiritual component to his thought. He intentionally calls that from his belief, but he's still an idealist in that he has a sort of big picture transcendent idea of how history and the world works, that it's moving towards something. He is not a pure materialist in the sense that there is only physical matter determining everything, right? The human spirit is the spirit behind it, but there's still some kind of spirit at work in the world. So he reworks all of this Hegel stuff so that instead of God, you begin with nature, right? Human nature specifically, but we can sort of use the capital N nature to include all of existence, working through history, leading us towards freedom and reason.
Yeah, the materialism here, I mean, Marx is a materialist in the sense that he denies that God exists and thinks that the only thing that exists is matter in the world. But like when we talk about historical materialism, like the materialism bit here refers to like the means of production, right? And so the big difference between Marx and Hegel is that Hegel sees us all being driven by the idea or the spirit of the world manifesting itself. And ideas are populating themselves into social structures and social institutions.
Which Marx sees that too. It's just a different spirit.
Well, yeah, but it's not some abstract idealist spirit. It's the means of production. Like everything about a society, its values, its mores, its institutions, its political values, all of that is driven by the means of production. So it's and just certain like facts about how people provide for themselves.
Right, but
so, that's the big break between Marx. I mean, it's teleological in that sense, and he thinks that all of this is driving towards a certain kind of culmination in history. But the important point is that it's all being driven by the modes of. By the means of production.
Well, right, and that's like you said, that's another way he switches Hegel. So he he jettisons God. So instead of God working through history, leading towards freedom, reason, Geist, and so on, it becomes nature working through history, leading to freedom, reason, and Geist. But then he still has the problem of there is a teleological movement at work in history.
Yeah.
And if you've stripped God out, you still have to have some kind of mind at work behind it.
Why not just say that it's the means of production and like certain deterministic facts about the means of production?
Because that's not what Marx says. There is the means of production are not the driving force; they're the result. So he flips history and freedom so that it's nature working through freedom and reason that leads to the movement of history, that leads to forward movement. So man becomes the person, the being that determines the course of history. Man becomes the master of his own history. And if it seems like, you know, we study history and it doesn't look like man's in charge of it, you know, there's all this suffering, and, you know, if you're really in charge of history, would you choose to sit through a genocide? Marx's response is, well, not all men are in charge of history. Much of history is the history of oppression and rule by a few men. History is directed by people. It's just a few people doing the directing. But now we know that, and once we know that, the logical conclusion is that we can rise up and throw off these oppressors and take control of our own history. So yes, there is the materialistic break with Hegel. I would still lump Marx as an idealist because he replaces God with man and puts him in charge of history. Beyond just the material means of production, man rather uses the means of production to shape his own history. The only real question is, which men are doing it? Is it just the few? Is it the middle class, the bourgeois? Is it the proletariat, which of course is the ultimate goal, is that it's everyone? And anything else on that? I mean, I have a couple of other things about the...
Go ahead.
Obviously, assumptions are being made here about sort of the nature of man, right? So one thing that's being assumed in Marx is that man is primarily shaped by the structure of the world he lives in. So there's not sort of an inherent human nature that all of us are born with, right? There's not the image of God in us or original sin or anything like that. We're sort of at worst blank slates that are written on by culture and society. But really, he's basically saying mankind is this sort of good being that gets corrupted by the structures that he lives in. There's the idea that there's a problem in history that needs to be fixed by mankind. We need to take control and move things in a right direction, which means we need to realize where we're at in the stages of history. So Marx comes up with a formula, a view of history that is, again, inspired by Hegel's, but not directly the same as Hegel's. And Ed, do you want to go through that? I feel like I've been talking for a while.
Yeah, right. So Marx thinks that human society throughout human history in all of its forms has been driven by the means of productions that define that society. And again, just as in Hegel, Hegel tells this evolutionary story of ideas making themselves real in the world, but then those ideas have certain paradoxes that clash and lead to their collapse and then lead to the next thing in the evolution of society. Marx tells a similar kind of story, but in this instance, what's driving it isn't some grand spirit or God. It is the means. It is the means of productions that define that society. So for Marx, we start the first stage in mankind's historical development was just living in this period of tribal ownership. In which you have in a very undeveloped existence in which people just hunt and fish. And so you have this very simple hunter-gatherer society. This society can evolve and advance, and so in its most advanced state, agriculture develops, but regardless, the division of labor is very elementary and more or less corresponds to the natural division of labor within the family. The overall social structure is just an extension of the family. So you have a kind of a patriarchal tribal leader, and you have members of the tribe, and you know, who are like members of the family. Slavery arises as population grows and as trade develops. And then you get the next stage, which Marx calls just primitive communism. And this stage arises when several tribes unite by agreement or conquest. And there are a couple distinctive aspects of primitive communism. While there is still mainly common ownership of goods, especially over slaves, private ownership over immovable assets begins to emerge here. So you begin to have people owning their own things, owning their own land and homes, etc. And as a result, you start to get a distinct classes starting to form between citizens and slaves. And then eventually this emerges and evolves to feudal society. And so here, ownership over land is rooted in communities, but it's worked not by slaves, but by a kind of enserfed small peasantry class. And this creates a hierarchical system of land ownership. And you start to get a divide between town and country. Within towns, guilds begin to form and arise. But the property ownership that matters most is land in the country. And individual labor with small capital commanding the labor of the journeyman into the city, right? So people in the country start to move into cities, join guilds, and begin to work. And so now you have this division of labor rapidly developing, town and country, and then within the town, the development of individual trades. And again, the story that you get here is that, like, this constant evolution, like, tribal ownership works for that stage of human development. I mean, there just isn't the assets and the evolution of certain ideas at that point in time. But, like, it works. But then it grows to a certain point, but then kind of achieves the point at which it goes as far as it can and gives birth to, like, this next stage. And you can also see how the mode of production in each of these stages corresponds to, like, social hierarchies and political institutions. So again, you go back to tribal ownership, and the political institutions, the social institutions that you have, are basically just an extension of the family. But then as society evolves, you need more, and as production evolves, as there's a little bit more trade, as there is more conquest of neighboring peoples, you start to get more developed social political institutions. And then you move to feudal society, in which you get this really clear distinction between, you know, a peasantry class and a kind of a noble, empowered class. So again, you have this evolution of society because of the modes of productions, but then those modes of productions require or call forth particular kinds of political institutions. And then the feudal society and the development of these guilds gives way to the birth of capitalism. And
yeah, I mean, we should go ahead and just finish the sort of Marx narrative, because capitalism, it is different than feudalism, but it's part of the same stage of world history. It's sort of the chunk of time from the Roman world down until socialism and communism arise, right? I mean, there are different shades of what's going on there, but through the whole spectrum, what's happening to man is that man is becoming alienated from nature, right? We're being driven away from who we're supposed to be, according to, you know, the creatures that we are. History, mm-hmm. reason, freedom, and nature are all falling out of sync with each other, and the more capitalism you get, the worse it gets. It was bad under the Roman world when you have, you know, slavery in place. It was worse under feudalism, the early modern world with mercantilism. Well, it was yet worse, and now that we've hit capitalism, it's sort of the worst of the worst. Right, we're at this point where man is completely alienated. So you have people working in factories for others that they don't know, with people that they don't know. Nobody cares about anyone else. The product that you work, the things that you're making with your own hands, have no actual connection to your day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. Your soul, your Geist is being crushed. Again, by these big impersonal forces that have developed historically because of the work of a few men, which is not to say that those few men are doing this on purpose, right? It's not like there's this conspiracy out there to crush the freedom of humanity. It's just sort of the nature of the few in power that they want to stay in power, and the way they do that is through these increasingly mechanized processes.
Yeah, and so. All of this develops into capitalist production. So you have these guilds in the end of feudal society that start to generate wealth. And because they're generating wealth, they're starting to grow powerful and able to replace the classes of people that had previously been in power because of family and nobility and title. But because these guilds are starting to develop economic power, they're starting to get social and political power, and usurping those former noble persons who had social and political power. And this is basically like the history of Downton Abbey, right?
Right.
As the old noble families go by the way and are replaced by like these new industrialists and bankers.
So you're saying Downton Abbey is a preparation for communism?
It is the history of the birth of capitalism is what it is. And you also, importantly, you get the division of labor.
Right.
And so it formerly, when you were working for the guild, you were a cobbler. And so it was artisanal production. And each person was sort of working on every aspect of the shoe and finishing the shoe. And there's a way in which the craftsman could experience like a lot of pride and satisfaction in that.
Right. You would have this thing you could hold and say, I made this.
Yes, exactly. Look at my skill and my abilities. Look at this beautiful thing that I've crafted.
You're a whole person connected to sort of the community, the natural world, in a very organic place.
Yeah. So a big part of Marx's theory is this understanding of human beings being homo faber. We're not homo sapiens or homo faber. We're productive man. Part of what gives us great satisfaction and flourishing is working under the right kinds of conditions. And so you can see the way in which guild production can be very satisfying. But what happens is the mercantile class grows, the division of labor happens, production moves into the factory that's owned by the single bourgeois property owner who owns the factory, who owns the means of production. And now people are working on assembly lines. We go back to the shoe factory, but it's no longer like artisanal handmade craftsmanship, but it's somebody whose sole job is to put the soles on shoes. So they're just sitting there and the shoes go by and they're just mechanically hammering the sole to the shoe. And they're doing that for 8 or 10 or 12 hours a day.
For a shoe they will never wear.
Yes, for a shoe that they will never wear, worn by a person who they will never know, engaging in this drudgery under the worst kinds of Charles Dickens late 19th century English dystopian industrial production. And so they're experiencing alienation. Alienation is this really central concept for Marx. And it refers to the way, well, alienation manifests itself in a number of different ways. We're alienated from the product of our labor. So again, we make the shoe, but we are alienated from the shoe itself. Whereas formerly, under artisanal craftsmanship, you would like look and hold the shoe and identify with it. You're alienated from the productive activity itself. So whereas we would find a great deal of satisfaction and meaning from the work and labor itself, now sitting on the assembly line, we're alienated from that. And so we are alienated from what Marx calls our species being, right? We are alienated from our very nature as who we are as human beings, as productive creatures. And then ultimately this creates alienation from other people. As we are living under these conditions, as we are fighting for scarce jobs, we get alienated from other people, right? So this particular mode of production is like the last evolutionary development in this long process, starting from tribal ownership, that just sort of leads to the total debasement of human life. It's also sort of worth pointing out that maybe we'll get to this bit later, but also, like, with this mode of production, it brings a lot of good things, right? It brings the creation of wealth. It brings the rise of the standards of living. It leads to all kinds of new and better and cheaper goods. It leads to the development of certain of science and technology. It's better than the old way, right? There's a reason why we evolved to this state of capitalism. It's better than feudal society, which was better than primitive communism, which was better than tribal ownership. It is getting better, but at the same time, it is groaning under the weight of certain kinds of paradoxes. And even as it produces all of these good things, it all ultimately leads to, like, the dehumanization of persons.
And this is where this is where later Marxists have something of an advantage, because they're not afraid to use religious language, or I don't know, afraid is probably not quite the right word, but they're willing to use religious language in a way that Marx isn't, right? Because you could say the material conditions of life are getting better, even as the spiritual conditions of life are getting worse. Mm-hmm. Marx doesn't let himself say that. It's hard to say, I care most about material stuff. Material stuff is getting better, but look what it's doing to the people who are making it. Right? Look at the spiritual, psychological, I guess, would be sort of the secular way to say it, the psychological drain on the worker. And it's just not worth it.
Yeah. So you have all of these people laboring in these inhumane conditions. Equally, what's going on here is that the nature of capitalist production and capitalist competition forces the bourgeois factory owner to invest in technology and improving the means of production, right? So I own a factory, I'm producing shoes. You start a factory and start producing shoes. And, you know, you start selling shoes at a dollar less than I am, and so I start losing business. And so this competition sort of forces people to produce shoes as efficiently as possible. So what I do is I invest in new technology and in machines in which I can produce the same number of shoes but for fewer people, right? So I'm able to lower the cost of my good while still taking home the same profit that I was before. And then you do the same thing. Right. And so we sort of have this dueling competition of reinvesting in the productive process, replacing human beings with machines. And so we're able to lower costs. But then increasingly what happens is wages get suppressed. Right. As technology advances, we need fewer and fewer workers because there are more and more workers. Competition for jobs becomes more fierce and wages get suppressed. And so you have more and more unemployed workers who are scrapping for fewer and fewer jobs with less and less pay. This is sort of the paradox of capitalism, that in its very nature, capitalism is going to generate a large class of a large class of working people who are increasingly immiserated as they're fighting over scarcer and scarcer jobs and lower wages. And it ultimately gets to the point in which the proletariat is immiserated enough that they decide to take up arms against their oppressors, and they overthrow the bourgeois and they take over ownership over the means of production. And that's what leads to the evolution to this final stage of these epochs of historical development, the beginning of communism.
Well, maybe one step before that is the introduction of socialism, right? So the facilitator of this communist revolution is the introduction of government into the business world. So it's not full communism, but it's the bridge that the communist revolution is to use, right? Mm. So if originally, you know, someone tricks people into leaving primitive communism, and puts us on this path to feudalism, to capitalism, capitalism becomes the new state of things, but this does develop into socialism. So there's some idea that politics is going to be the way to fix this problem of alienation and fragmentation and separation from each other and the problem of production and so on. But socialism is what introduces the idea that it's possible. And then the communist revolution is the step beyond that, which has its own stages.
So this communist stage itself has sort of two stages. The first stage is what Marx calls the dictatorship of the proletariat. And this is defined by the fact that the state itself takes over ownership over the means of production. So you still have a state that that's in charge in organizing social life and takes over the ownership of the means of production. But now the profit from that factory production is going to be shared amongst all. But then eventually it gets to the point that because you no longer have a class-based society, because there's now just a single class of persons who are sharing the fruit of their labor equally, Marx thinks that you just get to a point at which you no longer need government itself, actually. Social strife and social conflict only arises out of inequality and exploitation. Once you get rid of all of that, once everybody has everything that they need, once productive activity becomes humanized again, we actually won't need a state anymore, in which we sort of ascend to true communism, in which we don't even need a state anymore because all of the sources of social conflict have been eliminated, and we're kind of living in this utopian society in which, importantly, people are still working. You know, one important bit here that maybe we'll talk about in our the second half of this episode, something that I want to get to, is the fact that, like, achieving this communist state requires history working through this process. And importantly, you can only get to communism once you've achieved a certain state of technological sophistication and innovation. So for one thing, the communist revolution itself isn't going to happen until the proletariat has been sufficiently immiserated, right? That is to say, once technology has advanced to the point in which you're able to, in which unemployment rises to the point in which people are motivated to overthrow the system. But then equally, in communist society, it's like you need those advanced machines in order for communist society to work. Because Marx has this vision in which people are going to work, but they're going to work less, and they're going to have more time on their hands to sit and to read and to write poetry and to fish and to get back to nature and to relate to their fellow human beings and all of that, right? But that's only going to work if the factories are able to run themselves,
right?
So We achieve communist society, the elimination of formal political institutions. We achieve that only because society achieves a certain level of technological advancement, the level that both precipitates the immiseration of the proletariat, but also enables us to sort of live in this kind of utopian society, because the robots are doing all the work.
Right. Well, and it's utopian because, again, Marx has this idea that we are primarily shaped by our cultural, institutional, political structures, and those structures have now been fixed. So the problems of mankind have also been fixed, right? We're now psychologically adjusted and in tune just as much as we are fixed materially. History, nature, human freedom, reason, Geist, and so on are now lined back up with each other. We've sort of hit the end of history, the teleological end of history. Although I will say you missed one step in the revolution itself. That's when the workers rise up and kill the rich and distribute their wealth to everyone. It's sort of the very first stage of the revolution is a very bloody one. And I think Marx thinks it's a mistake, but a reasonable one, at least from the perspective of the proletariat.
Yeah, you know, one thing about Marx is that Marx very much understood himself to be doing social science or science, not philosophy. Like, this is meant to be a kind of a materialist explanation of everything that has happened and everything that is going to happen. And in this regard, Marx understands himself very differently than the other political philosophers who we've talked about in our other ideology episodes do. You know, whether they were liberal or conservative or libertarian, they were doing normative political theory, right? They were talking about the way in which things should go. Marx understands himself as like doing science. This is the way things have happened because of certain deterministic material conditions, and this is what's going to happen.
Right.
It's not like this is what should happen, this is what's going to happen. Though there's obviously a debate between subsequent Marxist thinkers about what exactly the revolution is going to look like and how violent it needs to be. But anyways.
Well, and subsequent Marxist thinkers do tend to be more philosophers, right? Where Marx would say, I'm just telling you what's coming, they're going to say, we want this to happen. This is our goal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, another difference sort of between the two. How about this? So we've walked through kind of the major ideas in Marx with the understanding that, you know, Marx has thousands of pages of documents out there, and we've been talking about him for 50 minutes. So there's obviously a lot more that we could go into. But Ed, why don't you give us your thoughts on Marx? So not on where Marxism goes, but on Marx himself. Is he right? Is he wrong? What is he worth reading to get out of him? Where does he misfire? Right? What does he get wrong? What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, good. So you're certainly right about. And Marx is a super difficult thinker, if only because there are reams and reams and reams of writings. A lot of it doesn't get published. A lot of it is just in process, and there are there are not thousands of pages. There are tens of thousands of pages of pamphlets and little books that do get published, and then massive works that don't get published in his lifetime, and notes and all of that. And so it's difficult to put it all together. I mean, to me, I would say that, like, the real genius of Marx, and we'll talk about his applicability to the early 21st century and what's going on these days in a part two to this episode. But to me, the real genius of Marx is just highlighting the way in which the means of production, the influence that they have on every other aspect of our social lives, right? So it's easy just to think about that in terms of the way in which we provide for ourselves. But the way in which we provide for ourselves requires or calls forth ways of organizing our social lives together. I mean, in some ways, like, nothing is more basic than the means of production because, again, that's how we survive, right? There's no human life. There's no culture or ideas or religion until, like, we're surviving and able to provide for ourselves. It's like the means of production are the most basic things. And the means of production for a particular society requires a particular kind of social organization. And then that social organization requires a certain way of thinking about ourselves and way of thinking about our common life, right? So it gives birth to philosophy and theory and pictures of human nature and art and all of that. Like, all culture sits on top of it. And it's not like I'm a historical materialist determinist in Marx's sense. But there is a way in which I think, and to broaden the point a little bit beyond just the means of production, but just like our social institutions themselves have a kind of materiality that determines and shapes the ideas that we have floating around in our heads and the things that we care about. It is unthinkable to imagine democracy without capitalism, I think. Capitalism requires certain kinds of social political forms. Obviously, I mean, you have a country like China that's experimenting with capitalism, but even as you have the introduction of capitalism, right, you find it's almost like demanding certain kinds of democratic forms of political organization. So that's one big point, just sort of like highlighting the importance of the modes of production. And then just a second point, and again, this is something that we'll be talking about in a second half to this episode, just the analysis of capitalism and like what's awesome about capitalism, but also certain kinds of paradoxes about capitalism, the stress and strains that it creates, the inequality that it generates. I mean, I wouldn't describe myself as being Marxist in any way, shape, or form, really. But I do find the analysis of capitalism and its discontents to be very interesting. I do think that there's a way in which the stress and strains of capitalism need to be dealt with, or they're going to generate really severe social strains. And I think you can see that right now. I think you can see that in the rise of the Trump voter, right? Because industrialization and capitalism beget globalization. And you can just see the stress and strains of globalization on the working class in the United States and the politics that it engenders. And, you know, I don't think that the landing place for this is going to be a kind of utopian communist society. And I certainly hope that the political form that's better than this is going to happen without a bloody revolution. But I do think that the stress and strains of capitalism need to be dealt with by different kinds of political institutions. How about you, Coyle? What interests you, or what do you take away from this bit of Marxist analysis?
Like you, I agree with some of the critiques of capitalism, and we'll get more into this when we talk about Marx's influences on the 20th century left, but I basically agree that at the end of the day, capitalism itself is deeply unfulfilling, especially when it's treated as its own end. And that's where people on my particular side of the political spectrum have often been guilty of saying, you know, look, capitalism is ultimately what we need to make us happy and prosperous and free. Now, that said, if you sort of force me to choose, I will always take capitalism over Marxism. I think it is the lesser of two evils, but that's not the same thing as saying it's not an evil, and it is often evil in the way that Marx talks about it. So I agree with him about some of his analysis on the alienation. His teleological view of history, even though I disagree with the particular framework he uses for it, it's increasingly rare to have thinkers who have a teleological view of history, so at least he has that. And it can be useful, I think, to use a sort of a jumping off point. I don't think history is moving towards this utopian historical materialist paradise, but it is still moving in a direction. And that can be, again, a useful sort of conversation point when dealing with people on the left in general or with Marxists overall. What he gets wrong, of course, are things that I've already sort of hinted at. His view of human nature is just completely wrong. Yes, we are certainly influenced by the societal structures we're born into, but they are not the be all and end all. We do have an inherent nature. I believe in original sin. I think the Bible is very clear about people being fallen, and no tinkering with society will ever fix that. You will never solve the problem of sin by reforming society. Marx and everyone who has ever followed him have just gotten that completely 100% wrong. And that's where I think, honestly, some of the best responses to that are often the dystopian novelists who sort of walk through how poorly that works. At least in a fictional sense, and in reality, again, we'll get to some of the 20th century attempts to apply this. We'll see how that just always ends in the gulag when you're trying to work it on the ground. His historical materialism, again, that's a place where I think he is wrong. People do have material needs; we can't deny that, but that's not all we are. We are more than just bodies. We are bodies and souls. We have one foot in a transcendent realm, We didn't talk about Marx's aesthetics because I don't know much about them. I don't know if you do either, but I know he had a lot of writings on it, and it's just an area of Marx scholarship that I'm not very familiar with. So maybe he would deal a little more with sort of the psychological component, the spiritual component of man in those writings. I just haven't read them. And yeah, I think those are the big things. So he gets alienation, some of his criticisms of capitalism, right. History has emotion, has a teleology, that's right. He gets wrong his view of human nature and his solution, the idea that you can fix people, that you can fix problems with policy, is just completely wrong. And I suppose go ahead.
It's interesting. So what both you and Marx and I share in common is his critique of capitalism. And then Marx thinks that the solution is communism, right? Neither you nor I think that the solution is communism. I think that the solution is going to be social democracy. You know, and then the interesting thing is, well, what do you, given this critique of capitalism that we three share, like, what is, like, the conservative? It would be interesting to sort of hear you pack.
Yeah, and so if we're...
Not that you have to answer that question this very second, but that's sort of like an interesting hanging question that we can get to maybe in the second part of this episode.
And I think it's a good question even here, because in the historical framework Marx builds, right, the only option he really leaves me if we're buying into his view of history is feudalism. So I guess I end up having to be the feudalist as someone who rejects who doesn't like some of the extremes of capitalism and who rejects communism. Well, maybe we need to go back to that older style where, you know, people are still working in the guilds. And honestly, I have some sympathy with that. I don't necessarily object to that. I think it is insufficient. But of the things we've talked about, feudalism, capitalism, socialism, communism. It's maybe the least attractive, or the most attractive. Again, I think there is more to mankind and more to history than that. I think we have spiritual transcendent options available to us that don't involve trying to solve the problem solely with material and political means. But if we're accepting his framework, I'm a feudalist. If we're not accepting his framework, we have many, many more options that we can go with. So maybe capitalism tempered by a religious people, or capitalism tempered by a tradition, or capitalism tempered by subsidiarity. You know, again, we could go through many different options.
Good. Yeah. That's super interesting. You want to take us out?
Yeah. We will continue our discussion of communism a few weeks down the road. Thanks for listening to another episode of the City of Man podcast. We are proud to be members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. For more information about our show or any of the other shows in the network, please visit christianhumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes if you like us. That's the best place to help people find our show. We would also appreciate it if you liked us on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. You can also send us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com, which we do check on rare occasions when we remember it. Sorry, we'll try to be better at that. On behalf of Ed, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.